everybody. Welcome to Hobbs and Friends of the OSR. I am your host, Jason Hobbs, and I just saw that it's been almost 6 weeks since I recorded a podcast, which is incredible because this actually usually comes out every 2 weeks. Before the con mess that I had in June, I had done quite a few in the can ahead of time, and we're back regardless. And I have a person that I have wanted to talk to for a long time. As all of you guys know, Adventure Conqueror King is one of my favorite systems of all time. And I actually have the author and the Autarch General, or the Autarch Archon, I guess, which is even higher than general, right? Alexander Macris. How's it going, Alexander?
Hey, it's going great. It's going great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no, I really appreciate you being on the show. So when I looked you up, it said that your author credits were basically all Adventure Conqueror King stuff. Is that true?
It is true. There's a few games I've worked on that don't show up there. When I was in college, I did a supplement for the Spearhead Micro-Armor War game called Blaze Across the Sands, which covered the North African campaign. And then in my last year of college, I created a game called Modern Spearhead, which was an adaptation of Spearhead for 1990s micro-armor battle. For a while, I worked in the video game industry, and I consulted on a bunch of video games. And then I designed one game called Heroes Mini, which was a promotional game for the Heroes of Might and Magic franchise. It was a web game. And that did pretty well, and we won an award for it. Around 2010, I decided to get back to, you know, my first love, which was tabletop role-playing game design.
Awesome. That's probably what the main topic will be, is game design itself. So I usually go through this, the introduction at least, and the next section is how we know each other. And we don't. I'm pretty sure you have no idea who I am, but I'm not sure. But I know who you are. And like I say, I've been playing Axe for almost since it came out, I think.
Awesome.
I didn't get out on the original Kickstarter, but a guy, Brian Tackle and Craig Brasco, turned me on to Adventure Conqueror King quite a while ago.
Oh, right on.
I'd already asked
Craig Brasco, the artist. He just did some art for me.
Yeah, he talks about that. He's excited because I'm the one who pushed him to actually get on the Discord channel and talk to you, actually.
Oh, right on. Yeah, he just did a great constellation map for the Aran Empire. So now we have constellations for all of our stars and a zodiac, et cetera. It was fun.
Yeah, Brasco is actually one of the best artists that I know that isn't really known by anyone. And I'm pretty excited that you actually used him for something.
That's so funny because I'm one of the best designers I know that isn't known by anyone.
I should have had Brasco on. He would have been excited.
Oh, man.
Okay, so now that we got past that, we can talk about what we've been doing in gaming recently. Do you want to go first?
Sure. Well, my latest project has been an adaptation of Lord of the Rings for Adventure Conqueror King system using the recently published Heroic Fantasy Handbook. So I call it Lothrax, and it's set in Middle Earth during the Middle Third Age. Obviously, there's a lot of material I can't publish from that due to copyright and trademark, but I'm learning a lot of interesting lessons and developing content that I think will eventually make its way to the Axe community after having been sterilized of any copyrighted trademark I don't own. But it's been a blast. We're using the Heroic Fantasy rules to their full extent and running around Middle Earth, playing for 5 hours a week, every week with a group of seven.
Wow, that's pretty awesome. 5 hour sessions.
Yeah,
then?
Yeah, we play 7 till 12 on Thursday nights.
Okay, man. Yeah. And that's at your at your house or something, or at your group, wherever you guys get together?
So one of our players is a successful tech entrepreneur. And so he has a wonderful house that has a third floor that's entirely devoted to gaming and, you know, with surround sound speakers and, hundreds and hundreds of miniatures and maps, et cetera. So we play there.
Oh, that's exciting. That sounds awesome. Way better than me going over to my rental house that I just kicked my renter out of and playing.
Hey,
playing there when
listen,
I have
if you have a rental house, you're doing better than me. So amen to that, man.
Oh, no. I'm not making any money off of it. It's terrible. I would say do not get into that business.
This is my second house I use just for gaming. It's kind of odd.
That would be nice if I could. Well, I've been paying the thing for a year without any help from the renter, so I might as well be.
Start charging your gamers, you know. Be like, hey, guys, this is our clubhouse and there's dues.
It's bad enough that I have a Patreon that people actually pay to listen to this podcast. So that's bad enough. All right. So I'll talk about what I've been doing. So I was at North Texas and I played and ran a ton of games there.
Awesome.
the thing that I was actually the most excited to see at North Texas is there was actually an Adventure Conqueror King game on that list.
Yes. The mixed GM.
Yeah. I had never seen that on a con listing before for an event. So when I saw it, I was immediately, I wanted to play. And we had a good time from, what's his name? Brian what? Isn't it Brian? Mixed GM, do you know?
I don't remember his last name, actually. It's Brian the Mixed GM. I'm sure he has one for IRS purposes or something.
Well, I know that he does because he actually played, I talked him into playing Warlords of the Purple Planet later, which is like a Harley Stroh's DCC kind of war game that's written by a game writer as opposed to a war game guy completely. And he killed me in that game, actually. Nice. So he was sitting next to me and killed me. But so that was fun. Anyway, Brian was awesome. And I actually kind of threw it out on my Twitter and to my community that you actually sent him Adventure Conqueror King core books for all the players.
I did. I was so excited that someone was running Axe at a convention that I wanted to, you know, make sure that there was a GM support program, which I really didn't know what to do. So I was like, well, I'll send you books. And that was great. So, you know, I would love to see more Axe convention play. I think I haven't tackled it because most of what I do in the game is focused on either the design side or sort of campaign level mechanics as compared to sort of writing 4-hour sessions for a convention. So, you know, I've reached out to Brian and a few other folks and said, hey, you know, if you guys want to do convention games, I would love to throw Autark support behind the effort.
Well, after that, I have decided I'm going to add it to a game that I run at cons as well. I normally run BX or DCC.
Both are great for cons, yeah.
I run Axe all the time, and honestly, for a con game, the Axe game is, my BX game is almost identical because most of the house rules that I use for BX are already in Adventure Conqueror King anyway. So, right. So sign me up for being one of the GMs as well. And I convinced Thaddeus Moore, who's on your Discord channel, he's going to run Adventure Conqueror King now as well.
Nice.
At awesome. Conventions.
Yeah, Thaddeus hangs on the Discord. He makes cool OSR patches.
Yeah, the OSR patches guy.
Yeah.
All right, so that was North Texas. Oh, I did play BX with Pete Segretti. Pete told us it was not going to be exactly Keep on the Borderlands, but it was. Sorry, Pete.
keep on the Borderlands is the adventure that just keeps on giving. I love that adventure.
It is fantastic. You even wrote your first Axe adventure based on that, pretty much, right?
Absolutely inspired by it. Absolutely, yes.
That Secret Stone of Sakara, is that you?
Sinister Stone of Sakara.
Sinister Stone.
Yeah, so the adventure proper was actually written by my friend Matthew Scale, mm-hmm. and I contracted him to create a dungeon that would have that feel that the Caves of Chaos did, where you had a congregation of humanoids as well as a chaotic temple area. And he came up with the idea of this magic item called the Sinister Stone that exerted a magnetic pull on creatures of evil. And that was what was drawing them all together into this area. And it also causes mutations over time. And so the deeper you go into the dungeon, it gets into more and more kind of Lovecraftian horror and weirdness. So it was a very fun adventure in that it takes the Keep on the Borderlands Caves of Chaos tropes and then just kind of like dials up the weird just a little bit, not like a huge amount because it's an introductory level adventure. So we still wanted it to feel really classic, but, you know, just a bit to keep it fresh for veteran players. And then I wrote the portion of the adventure that was the actual keep and the civilized areas, which was the Fortress of Turos Tem, an old Arum fortress.
I think I can almost tell that in the writing. It's way more Domains at War when you're going through all of the aspects of the keep and all that. See, that's the thing with Adventure Conqueror King. I'm not necessarily that good with what a lot of the people would call the really crunchy aspects, mm-hmm. but you don't really have to be with Adventure Conqueror King. You can just, like I say, it's almost like a house ruled BX or something. So
yeah, what I wanted to do was to have the crunch there, but have it hidden behind a layer of familiar mechanics. So that if you didn't really want to worry about it, you could just rely on the assumptions and know that it was going to be fine.
Yeah.
But then if you wanted to really dive deep and say, well, what would it mean if I did this? Then you could pop open the hood and you could, you know, play with the switches and dials.
Yeah.
So I feel like we succeeded pretty well because a lot of people have have said, oh, yeah, it plays just like BX, which is not really true. There's actually some very subtle differences, but it plays close enough that a lot of the crunch has really been kept invisible from the casual people who are turned off by too much crunch.
I'm going to try and get through this quick so we can, we're already talking a lot about game design and I'm really excited about that. So I also, at Origins, I ran Kalmata for like 7.5 hours, which is the BX game I'm talking about.
Nice.
And I ran a DCC, my adventure, that is published in the newest Dam magazine.
Oh, nice. DCC is one of the best con games ever made, I think.
It is. And I think that's one of the reasons that it's blown up in the way that it has.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a great game. All right. So I also ran Kalmata online for some guys on my live stream on Tuesday. And Monday, we played Operation White Box Twilight 2000 with the great Thaddeus Moore running.
Oh, so, awesome. So that's taking the Twilight 2000 setting, but using it with the great Operation White Box rules.
Exactly.
Yeah. I love that system. Best rules for suppressive fire I've ever seen in any game. When I read them, I actually had to put the game down and just stop and admire them. They were so good.
That's good. I'm sure Mr. Pete Spahn would love to hear that. We'll send this to him so he listens to it. So I guess that's that. And now we're on to everything about you. I'm not going to explain what that is today for the listeners because Thaddeus told me that I do it too often and I'm wasting his time. Sorry, Thaddeus. So I explained it to you.
You did.
Alex is just shaking his head. Why don't you go first?
All right. Well, so I'm supposed to say one thing about myself. I designed my first war game at age 20. It was Modern Spearhead, a micro armor war game. And I literally just emailed the game designer who had done the original Spearhead. I was a big fan of his work. I introduced myself and he and I got along and he ended up giving me the opportunity to design that. So that this guy, his name was Artie Conliff, and he was very much my first game design mentor who taught me a lot of what I learned about game design. So cheers to you, Artie.
Awesome. Yeah, cheers to you, Artie. I have no idea who you are, but you sound like a great dude. So what I learned and everything about, well, what I'm going to talk about is I should not go to cons 2 weeks in a row. That is way too much stuff. I was dead. I've just gotten healthy now after being home for about a week and a half, enough to do a podcast really, because before that my voice was unrecognizable and I couldn't talk for more than 30 seconds or a minute without coughing.
Con flu, man. Bad news.
Yeah. And I normally don't get it. I use hand sanitizer constantly while I'm at the con and I try not to shake hands. And of course I don't make out with any gamers or anything like that. Right. So I'm usually fairly sanitary when I'm there. And yeah, so there you go. All right. So thank you for that. And like I say, it's awesome having you here. And we're finally past the introduction. Awesome.
Da, da, da.
All right. So this is going to be a series of shows where I'm talking to game designers and talking about their specific game design process. And like you've already kind of mentioned maybe where you started doing game design. Do you want to talk any more about like your history of game design, or do you just want to really just get into the process that you went through when you designed Adventure Conqueror King?
You know, I feel like I covered the history. Let's just jump into process.
Oh, awesome, man. Yeah. So, all right. Where do we start? What made you decide to write Adventure Conqueror King, I guess, or design it?
Well, it was two factors. First, at the time, back in 2008, I was running The Escapist, which was an online magazine for geek culture. And we did a fantastic article written by Alan Varney, himself a tabletop game designer, who talked about the old school renaissance and how people were getting back to playing Dungeons & Dragons the way it used to be. And that article that Alan commissioned really inspired me. I read about what some folks like James Malczewski were doing, and I said, you know, I bet this would be really fun. And so I put away all my contemporary RPGs, and I started running BX for my local gaming group. And we had a blast. And as we started to play, I kept writing house rules every time I stumbled into an area that was vague or an area I disagreed with. But mostly I started writing house rules because the gameplay that I wanted to do wasn't fully supported by BX, because I really wanted to tie in war games, because that was my other big passion in addition to role-playing games. And around 2010, my wife mentioned to me, she said, you know, you're putting so much time into doing all this work, you really should think about publishing it. So I reached out to a couple of the other folks I knew from The Escapist who had been in this space. you know, they saw the appeal. And so we put our minds together and we created Autark and we launched our first Kickstarter. We were all frankly surprised and delighted to raise over $10,000 for the first product. So Axe was very much a product of my house rules combined with Tavis Allison's house rules for BX. That was the baseline of the game.
All right. That's awesome. So what made you guys do this racist class, but not really racist class? Basically, race being individual about, or how would you explain that, I guess? You know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely. Okay. Well, there were a few things. First, we really liked the quote-unquote class of elf in BX. And I think that that class, in some weird way, was a platonic ideal that many people have of the character who can both cast spells and fight in melee combat. And every version of D&D since has had some variant thereof that has never quite made it. You know, you had in AD&D, you had the elven fighter magic user. In third edition D&D, you had the Duskblade. Then in fourth edition, you had the sword mage. Fifth edition, you have the eldritch warrior. And everyone is trying to scratch that same itch that BX successfully scratched way back when. My starter premise was they got something right here. But then at the same time, there was this issue where, well, there are other types of elves than just this one type of elf. There's other types of dwarves than there's just one type of dwarf. And so I started to think, well, what if each class had its own set of characters? And then when I realized that when I went down that design path, it solved another problem that new school gaming had begun to irk me with, which was that people chose race as a matter of min-maxing rather than choosing race as a matter of culture and aesthetic and feel. So you would see people who would choose a mountain dwarf because it gave them better armor to use with their cleric of water. And despite the fact that culturally speaking, mountain dwarves were supposed to hate water, that particular min-max combo was great. And that really irked me. So I decided, let's dive in. Let's make each race have its own set of classes. And then that will let us build in the flavor and the aesthetic of the race into the mechanics and avoid the min-maxing problem.
Yeah, and that's great. But I would say that it isn't necessarily a new game thing. It's something that was going on since 1E. Because in my group, back in the 80s, that's why people were taking elves, or because of just the bonuses the race gave them, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they were all the same. And and people complain about racist class because they don't like the idea of, oh, why do all dwarves, are we playing Star Wars or Star Trek, the original series now? All Klingons are exactly the same. Right. All dwarves are exactly the same. And Axe does a good job of saying they're not, and you can have different actual classes and not just say they're not, you know, so that's a very good idea. And this kind of shifts into the player's companion, where how long after Adventure Conqueror King came out did the player's companion come out?
1 year later. Yeah.
1 year, and it was its own Kickstarter as well?
It was its own Kickstarter. And I had already started writing the player's companion before Axe was ever published. A lot of the classes that appeared in the player's companion were classes that had appeared in my campaign prior to that. And the class building system that appeared in player's companion originally appeared in a much more limited framework, I think in a Dragon magazine from the 80s. And then that had been like this sort of Lego box system that I had been working on layering on top of for years. And then I started to recalculate all of the classes on the basis of this Lego block system. And then I handed it over to my players and they built atop it. And at a certain point, it was clear that, you know, this was a whole separate product. What I created specifically for the Kickstarter was the magic design system. So the mechanics that allowed you to create your own spells. And that was probably the most challenging design task I've ever had to do. Because, of course, the spells that appear in BX and AD&D weren't designed using that system. The system was reverse engineered from the spells. And so it was attempting to impose order on something that was actually a chaotic amalgam of 30 years of gameplay by hundreds of different people. There were certain times I really felt like I was staring into the abyss and I would never solve it. But, you know, eventually it was like, it almost felt like some sort of like Newtonian apple falling on my head, where the system of the world revealed itself. And of course, that's not really the case, because we know that the system didn't exist before it was created. But that's how it felt. Like, it felt more like I discovered it than that I created it. And that was a cool feeling.
Yeah, I imagine. So I think between the two books, Adventure Conqueror King and The Player's Companion, it's a really complete game. Maybe one of the most complete fantasy games, honestly. But because when anyone asks me why do I like Adventure Conqueror King, I have kind of a canned answer. But I'm curious, what do you think makes Adventure Conqueror King a good reason? You know, why when someone asks you, hey, why is this game just better than playing BX or something? What do you normally say?
I have a couple different answers, depending, I think, on what the interests of the person are and how hard I'm trying to sell them, I suppose. But the first thing I will say is that I think Adventure Conqueror King does a better job of implementing the mythic cycle of classical heroism than the games that followed on. If you look back at the cycle of mythic heroes, people like Perseus, Theseus, Arthur, they rise from adventurer to king. And we see that same mythic cycle in Aragorn, in Conan. And I wanted to have a game that made that possible. And, you know, various versions of D&D had hinted at it, suggested at it. Frank Mentzer's BECMI delivered on it, but it did so over a 36 level curve in a kind of gonzo world that I didn't love, with some weird economics that I didn't love. And so I felt like with Axe, we've actually made a game where you can go from lowly thief to guild boss of the crime syndicate. You can go from mage's apprentice to wizard in his tower, you know, ruling a realm of darkness with, you know, undead monsters. You can go from barbarian to ruler of a civilized empire. And the mechanics are there at every stage of play. It happens organically. It's embedded in the game, and it always feels like D&D from start to finish. So that to me is its big selling point. Now, if you start to narrow down to at a very fine grained level, I think there's a couple innovations in Axe that make it better than, say, BX, its closest competitor. One, I think, is the cleaving rules combined with the fighter damage bonus, which transform fighters from an underpowered class into a class that keeps up its value and its utility all the way through the entire leveling curve. I think a second is the abandonment of Vancian casting in favor of spontaneous casting combined with a small repertoire, which I think combines the best of wizards and sorcerers from 3.5. And then I think the multiple classes per race is a great innovation to the game. And finally, I think the Mortal Wounds table and the Tampering with Mortality tables are the best means I've seen of handling character mortality and character death in any of the various OSR games. So those are the four like differentiating mechanics that I think would say, even if you don't care about domain mechanics, even if you don't care about becoming a king, these are good reasons to play Axe.
And that's totally true. I use the cleaving rules in my BX game. I use the Mortal Wounds table in my BX game. We use sort of, I mean, we use a death save. So you just have a saving throw if you are knocked to zero or below hit points. If you fail it, you're dead. If you pass it, then I roll on the Mortal Wounds table and then just kind of make something up based on that.
It's great. I mean, there's tons of ways you can implement it. What I wanted to avoid, and, you know, and really Tavis Allison has to take the credit here, because he was the one who really unlocked the table. But what we wanted to avoid was, you know, that situation you were seeing in fourth edition really noticeably at the time that we wrote it, where the fights felt more like one of those carnival games where you're bonking hedgehogs as they pop up and then they go down and then they pop back up again. And that's what it felt like. You're like, oh, I'm down to -7. Oh, I'm back up. Oh, I'm down. Oh, I'm back up. You know, it became silly. Like you couldn't even take the combat seriously.
Yeah. It abstracted to a place that, like you say, it was silly, basically goofy almost, and it just didn't make a lot of sense. I totally agree with that. So a couple of things in Axe. A person just told me that they bought it after me talking to them at a panel at Origins, talking about Adventure Conqueror King, and they're like, oh, I bought the books. And it actually says on the back that the proficiency system is optional. Now, the guy that I play, the only reason we're not playing Axe all the time is because this guy says, I don't want skills in my BX. That's skills are bad or whatever. And this is Eric Hoffman, who's been on the show multiple times and is one of my very good friends. He's wrong a lot of the times, but, you know, that's what friends are for. So
exactly.
What made you decide to add proficiencies to Adventure Conqueror King?
Well, we played about half of the original Aran Empire campaign without proficiencies. I was inspired to add proficiencies by an amazing blog post by a guy named BX Blackrazor. He wrote a book called BX Companion at some point, which I bought and highly recommend. And he suggested you could add some minor proficiencies to BX and really add a lot of character flavor. He was totally right. The trick was I wanted to figure out a way that you could add the proficiencies without having to redesign any of the character classes and without creating quote unquote feat chains that, you know, made certain choices bad or certain choices inevitably the ones to take. And so what we settled on was that you, the rate at which you accrued proficiencies would be based on the rate at which you advanced in saving throws. And a nice result of that was that fighters got more proficiencies than clerics and thieves, who got more proficiencies than mages. So it was a nice sort of balancing factor for, you know, again, what had been some of the more underpowered classes in BX. And then we made the idea that the proficiencies would be split between class and general, where general proficiencies were things that were just your everyday skills, and those could stack to represent expertise, and you could get some bonus from intelligence for them. And then the class proficiencies would be much more scarce, and they were about a level of a class ability, but they wouldn't stack. And so you would never get to a situation where you had to say, well, I have the weapon focus feat, which unlocks this, which unlocks this. They were just one-offs that you could add to play to make your character feel a little bit distinct. And it worked out really well. But I do think that they remain optional. I know lots of people who play Axe without using the proficiencies. I played 50 sessions of Axe without using proficiencies. I think that new school players really like them, though, because they enjoy character customization, and that's part of the part of what they love. But, you know, given with the player's companion, you can literally design a character class to your exact preferences if you want to. So you can achieve really high character class customization just by letting them do that and ignore the proficiencies. It's really up to you.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I honestly love the templates in there. A game like Adventure Conqueror King, you can be ready to play easily in 10 minutes. You just say, okay, roll on this template. You pick a class, roll on the template. You go, here it is. You're done. All right, now we're starting to play. And a lot of people would say, oh, it takes too long. You got these proficiencies. Well, the templates just have them right in there. So very simple. I've played multiple games of Adventure Conqueror King with the templates. In fact, you could easily print off each of those templates, and then that's how you start your con game. And maybe that's what I'm going to do. Do you like Alex or Alexander better? Does it matter? Or?
Alex is just fine. I use Alexander online simply because there's a international terrorist and criminal named Alex McCreese, so I try to avoid the Google overlap.
Oh. Oh, well, that makes sense. I didn't have that problem. All I got you was your TED Talk and all your books.
So. That's good, yeah.
All right, so I have one more thing, and if I have a gripe about Adventure Conqueror King, it is the attack throw.
Uh-huh.
What is going on with the attack throw, man? It seems very confusing to me for some reason. You have like a very concise way that I could tell people, or you could tell people, this is the attack throw, this is how it works, and then maybe go into why you decided to make the attack throw the way that you did as opposed to just a FACO or something similar.
Sure. All right. Well, there's a couple things. First, at the time that we released Axe, there was a big controversy within the D&D community about, you know, ascending AC versus descending AC and THACO versus attack bonus. And partly it was a little bit of a middle finger for me to both camps. But so beyond that, I was really taken with the idea that you should focus on the character having a number that he's rolling against rather than a number that the GM tells you. Like, I really like the idea that your saving throw of 16 meant you just need to roll a 16 or higher to succeed. And your hide and shadows throw of 12 meant that you needed to roll a 12 or higher to succeed. That seemed really, really clear to me. Like, a person would never have a question about that. What do I need to do to hide in shadows? Well, you need to roll a 12.
Player facing, yes, player kind facing. Of, right? It's all player and, facing.
And so then I said, okay, well, what if you just have an attack throw? And in order to hit someone, that's the number you need to hit. And then if they don't have any armor, their armor class is nothing, zero. No armor is zero. That makes total intuitive sense. So if I'm attacking someone with no armor, that's the number I need to roll. And then if I'm attacking someone who has armor, I need to roll a higher number. It seems super intuitive to me. But then in actual play, you know, a lot of judges have told me, well, I don't like to tell people the armor class. I like to keep that secret. Or My players feel like they need to calculate everything in reverse or whatnot. So I know there's a lot of folks that don't use it, but you know, we've used it in every campaign I've run, and I think the confusion, a lot of it does arise just because it goes against people's intuitions. They're used to saying, "Oh, I'm supposed to add something to my number," just because that's what they're used to.
Yeah, and it's not even necessarily intuition; it's learned behavior from years of playing games, right?
Right.
And if it was totally new people, they read it and they explained it to each other and just wanted to play without having someone who'd played for decades, it sounds very simple, actually. Oh, this is what I need to roll. So that makes sense to me.
No, in fact, when I have introduced it to new players and they've never had any problem, they're like, oh, okay, that's what I need to roll.
Makes sense.
Oh, yeah. He's got armor, so the roll is higher. Okay.
All right. So what about changing the probabilities from a D6 to a D20? Because it seems like that's pretty much what you did, right?
That's all I did.
For proficiencies and skills. So what made you wanted to just keep it more consistent, or what was your thought process there?
I wanted to have it be a consistent D20 throw for player activities as part of keeping everything on this player-facing throw system. And I wanted to be able to have more granularity. So for instance, if it's open door on 5-6, and so that's a 33% chance, there's no way to have the door have a 40% chance of opening. You know, it's either going to be a 33% chance or now it's a 50% chance. So there just wasn't much granularity. And I think that that limited some of the game mechanics you could do with exploration, and it limited some of what I could do with proficiencies. So it was a combination of desire for a unified mechanic combined with desire to have everything be this player-facing throw system combined with desire for more granularity.
Yeah, and I'm pretty impressed with that, because I'd never really seen it or even considered it or thought about it. And that it's just usually, oh, you just read the rules and do what they say. But it seems like you've taken a lot of what those things are and then tried to, like you say, make a more foundational or continuous, simple, consistent basis for the game. And I think that's really cool. And I appreciate that. Thanks.
Yeah. I mean, if I think about my design methodology, you know, I look at someone like James Roggi, and I have this sense of James as this amazing Van Gogh-like romantic painter who is, you know, combining these colors in this amazing way, and, you know, creating these, you know, vivid gameplay experiences for people. And I think of my approach as more like an architect, where I start off with an Excel spreadsheet in front of me. And I'm like, you know, how much of a load bearing buttress do I need to create in order to have a skyscraper? And I think the virtue of that is that I always know that my game designs have very stable foundations that aren't going to be knocked over in gameplay. You know, the downside to it is it probably takes me longer than it takes some people that start with kind of a top-down artistic vision. And I think it probably forecloses some creative avenues that just wouldn't occur to me because I'm starting from a very grounded place. Like, it just would never occur to me to say, like, hey, let's do a spaceship with giant blue centaurs that are giants and have a brood mother. Like, I just would never occur to me in a million years. Because the first thing I would think of would be like, well, how big would the spaceship have to be? And what sort of propulsion system would it need in order, you know, and what's the metabolism? I would never get there.
I'm surprised you're an OSR player and not like, well, not the champions isn't, or the hero system, but your thought process, it really reminds me of the hero system. So, and a guy that I used to play hero system with all the time, I introduced him to Adventure Conqueror King, and he just loved the math and the foundation, the way everything was basically built in a similar way almost to the hero system, even though the mechanics are nothing alike. It was just, you have a base foundation and then you built on that foundation. And
I have tremendous admiration for the hero system. For, one of my favorites is the DC Hero system by Mayfair Games, which was built on logarithmic math, the GURPS system, and the basic fantasy system, which is the basis for RuneQuest, I think are all exceptionally well-designed systems. But Dungeons & Dragons, for various reasons, pulled together a hand of cards in its game design that offer something that other games don't. That is, the success of Dungeons & Dragons is not incidental, it's not accidental, and it's not just a network effect. D&D does certain things right that other games don't do, that players miss when they play other games, which is why they keep coming back to D&D. And so what I was really trying to do was create a version of D&D that had the strength of the mechanical chassis of these other games that I loved, but had the virtues of D&D that I thought were important.
That's awesome, man. All right, so we are running out of time, as we always do on this show. I wanted you to get a moment, at least like a minute, to talk about your recent or your current Kickstarter, right?
Secrets of the Nether City. It's a kilo dungeon. It's not quite as large as a mega dungeon like Dwemermount, but it's larger than an ordinary dungeon. It's set in our implied setting of the Aran Empire, but it's usable with pretty much any setting that has some ancient evil civilization in it. Comes with a guide to convert to your own setting. It has hundreds of rooms. It has dozens of new magic items and monsters and spells. And it's been run many times successfully in campaigns by me and by others. So it's heavily playtested. It's being crowdfunded now on Kickstarter.com. It's also our first full-color product. So I hope you'll check it out.
Yeah, everybody should check it out. I own almost every single Autark product, except not do the last Kickstarter with Heroic Fantasy and the Barbarians. But one of the listeners actually gifted me with Barbarians already. So I still have every product, but Heroic Fantasy.
You should get Heroic Fantasy. It's one of the products I'm most proud of.
Awesome. I don't know. Do you read stuff about the OSR at all or not really?
I do. I've been trying to give credit to many of the really great thinkers in the OSR that have inspired me. I absolutely do. Yeah.
Okay. So is the OSR a community or a movement in 30 seconds?
I think the OSR began as a movement and developed into a community, which is the nature of such things. It was a movement that arose during fourth edition, which felt like was a rejection of many fundamentals of D&D that people were passionate about. And so they wanted to get back to those fundamentals. And in so doing, they found a community of like-minded people.
Well, listen to that then, Eric Tenkar. It sounds like Alexander Makris agrees with you, community. He's just uneducated, in my opinion. No, I'm just kidding, buddy. Thank you for that. So we're at the end of the show here, so I want to throw out some appreciation for my patrons. Like I always say, if I couldn't tell my wife that I actually get a couple dollars once in a while for doing this show, she probably wouldn't let me do it as often as I do. So Larry Haught, I met this guy at Origins, and he was in both of the panels I was in, and it was awesome for him to join and become a patron. Thanks, buddy. Stan Polson and Gordon Cranford have both started up their patronage as far as Gordon Cranford has, and Stan Polson have become $10 members, so they get invited to a game a month with me. I'm surprised that anyone would want to do that, let alone pay $10, but dudes, I really appreciate it. You guys are really the backbone of the Patreon, so thanks. I think you have a Patreon, right?
I do. It's an Autark Patreon, so not all of the contributions are from me. We have some great stuff from the community, too.
All right, so if you want to, where it says show notes down here, you can put any links down here that you want, like your Patreon or autark.com or .ca, is it? Any of those you can put at the bottom so people can find you. So if someone wanted to talk to you about any of this stuff, Alexander, how would they get in touch with you?
Best place to do it is the Autark forums. I check those every day. That's at autark.co. You can also find us on Google+. We have the Adventure Conqueror King community there. And we have a Discord for those who just can't get enough acts and want to talk about it all day long or random shit.
And dude, that Discord is hopping. There are a lot of cool people in there, and it doesn't feel as, like I always say, Discord feels like sometimes if you're in a large community with a lot of people in the same room, you're just kind of peeing into the ocean. You know, it might feel warm once in a while, but pretty much you don't even notice what anyone else is talking about. But your Discord seems pretty well established, and you talk on it a lot, and a lot of the people are very friendly. So that's a good Discord.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm glad you think so.
Yeah. If you wanted to reach me, I'm at the Twitters at Hobbs Indeed, or the podcast has its own Twitter at OSR and Hobbs. Honestly, I pretty much do both of those all the time. Chris, the editor, has some time, but so you can reach me at either one. I try to keep my gaming stuff at OSR and Hobbs and my professional job at Hobbs Indeed, but it all gets all mixed up and I'm fine with that. Or Jason Hobbs on G+. And the Patreon is www.patreon.com/OSRN Hobbs. The Google+ community is now up to 647 members. We're not as big as the Adventure Conqueror King, but I think there's a lot of crossover. Anyhow, I always love everyone being on there and appreciate it. You got any last words or anything, Alexander?
I try never to give any last words in case of my last words.
Don't they sound so final when you say that? Any last words? It's like, that sounds terrible. All right, so I should say that Hobbs and Friends BOSR is part of the Misdirected Mark Network, the media arm of Encoded Design.